barracks. The yacht was a new Marine 68 Fly. It boasted a 47-ton displacement and a cruising speed of 25 knots, and it had been rented out by the week from a service on Kowloon. Logistics personnel working at the SVR station in Hong Kong had acquired the vessel from the owners with an open-ended return date, stocked it for a week so it could house more than a dozen operatives and all their gear, then moored it in a slip at a large public docking facility. Then, the logistics personnel left it there. And soon after they left, Zoya and the task force arrived and climbed aboard. The boat was now crewed by Russian naval personnel brought down by Vladivostok, men who looked at this operation as a vacation from their normal daily grind on a coastal patrol boat, and they, as well as a team of security men brought in to secure the vessel, had no clue about the real mission of the main element of their small task force. This yacht was designed to accommodate 8 in luxurious comfort. Now, 17 in all, 16 men and 1 woman, lived in stifling proximity to one another, sleeping in shifts on every flat surface, their massive stocks of gear filling all the cargo holds as well as every possible nook and cranny below decks, even stowed under black tarps lashed to the main deck. The yacht had been docked in a mooring field north of the Hong Kong airport for the past 3 days, but the previous evening they'd relocated to this spot off Po Toi. Zoya had ferreted out information from a rival triad gang that a Chinese defector pursued by mainland intelligence in Hong Kong had been taken to Po Toi on a Wo Xing Wo speedboat several days ago. He was to be handed off to a cargo ship called the Tai Chin 6 that ran heroin back and forth between Wo Xing Wo and some Southeast Asian drug concern. The information was third-hand at best, but Zoya liked her chances, so she moved her task force here to set up shop off the island. After confirming the presence of Wo Xing Wo on the island and after a Russian spy satellite had found the ship heading back to Po Toi, Zoya and her task force decided their best chance for finding Fan before anyone else was to hit hard and fast soon after the ship arrived this evening. They didn't expect Fan to be on board, but they did expect the crew would know something of where the ship went last and possibly even who had Fan now. On the Russian yacht, a lone sentry armed with binoculars stood on the flying bridge and scanned the deserted shoreline to the west. On the main foredeck, 2 more crewmen readied diving gear, while inside the main deck saloon, 7 men pulled on neoprene suits. The operators were crowded, but they were accustomed to living and working in close proximity to one another. As members of the elite and secretive Zaslan Shield unit of SVR, this very team of paramilitaries had helicoptered across eastern Ukraine and Dagestan on direct action missions. They'd killed terrorists and kidnapped local rebel leaders in Chechnya after sitting huddled together in the back of armored vehicles for hours on end, and they parachuted into Syria to assist with the escape of a Syrian army general from a position being overrun by rebels. These men were all first-timers to Hong Kong, but tonight's mission was no different from others in their careers. They would raid a cargo ship from underwater, capture any on board who could be captured, and kill those who offered resistance. Vasily was in charge of the Zaslan team, with Yevgeny serving as his second-in-command. They stood in the middle of the saloon talking over last-minute details of the mission while everyone geared up around them. Just as the men began the final weapons and comms check in the tight room, the hatch to the lower deck rose and Zoya Zakharova climbed up from below. She wore a black neoprene shorty wetsuit, her bare legs and arms exposed. Her chin-length dark hair was pulled back and banded tight against her head, obviously so she could pull on the neoprene diving hood she held in her hand. On her right thigh she wore a sheathed knife, and over her shoulder she lugged a black backpack. She pulled a holstered Glock 26 pistol from the pack and dropped the bag and her hood on a chair in the saloon, then racked the slide of the weapon. As she slid the pistol into a holster on the utility belt and dropped it next to the pack, she checked the threads on the silencer, housed in a case on the belt. After doing this, she glanced up at the other men in the room. All 7 of the Zaslan operators just stood there, staring back at her.
"What?"
she asked. Vasily addressed the SVR officer.
off for a nighttime swim?
She looked back to her gear, then checked to make certain her three extra pistol magazines were in their pouches on the utility belt.
Don't start with me. I'm going with you.
No, you're not. Someone will come back to get you when a Taichin 6 is secure.
It's 10 minutes away, 20 minutes round trip. Plus, you might need me during the takedown.
We have 8 men. We need 8 men. Men.
Arseny and Peter both chuckled over by the navigation table. Zoya asked,
What if that tender onshore returns to the boat? I can stay on the deck and watch the bay for any counterattack.
Vasily knelt down to load rifle magazines into a load-bearing vest propped against the wall.
Not necessary. Ruslan and Sasha will stay with us just long enough to clear B deck. Then they will return to the main deck. They can keep watch for anyone returning to the boat during the operation.
I can help them. I won't get in your way. I've been in combat multiple times.
Vasily snorted.
Really? Where?
Zoya shrugged.
Classified.
Right.
You know I've trained at Yasineva with FSB Spetsnaz forces.
Vasily snorted.
Like I give a shit. They probably give you fluffy towels and massages.
No, they did not.
And we aren't FSB Spetsnaz, dear. We are Zaslon.
Which means you belong to SVR. I am an SVR officer, I remind you, and this is my operation.
All the men looked at Vasily, but the paramilitary commander didn't budge.
I have tactical control of direct action ops, and I say you stay here and wait for us to call you forward. End of conversation.
Vasily was technically correct. An SVR case officer had no authority to make herself part of the tactical team conducting a difficult, bottom-up raid on a ship full of potential hostiles. Still, they knew she'd passed all the Spetsnaz qualifications necessary to make her an asset to the op, not a detriment. So Zoya felt they should have no problem with her trailing along. But these guys were all ex-military, whereas Zoya was a civilian government employee, and of course, Zoya was a woman. These alpha males didn't want her fighting alongside them. She wouldn't push it. She needed their help in this, and even though she thought these guys were assholes, she wanted them to remain focused on the mission at hand, not on her. Zoya said,
Very well. I'll go to hide on the island when you stop to pick up Mikhail.
Mikhail is breaking down the hide. We won't need it.
Let me see you at work. I will give you overwatch during the raid, and I'll be closer than I am here.
To that, she added,
You can keep me off the boat, but you can't keep me off the damn island.
Vasily just shrugged, but before he could speak, Zoya's radio chirped.
Anna 7 to Sarina.
She grabbed her walkie-talkie out of her gear bag and brought it to her mouth, her eyes still locked on Vasily.
Go, 7.
I have another tender leaving the target vessel. 5 men on board, just like last time. They look like they are heading to that same bar the other subjects went to.
This was good news for the Zaslon unit. They would have fewer hostiles on board the cargo ship. But Zoya didn't like it. She had no idea how many would be on the ship when they hit it. Could it be possible that all the men who knew what happened to Fan Xiang would be drinking in the bar she'd visited that morning? In that case, Vasily and his men would have to wait around for them to return. Zoya looked to the Anna team commander.
That's 10 off the boat you are hitting.
I call that good news.
Not if all 10 come back at once.
Sasha broke into the conversation now.
10 men on 2 15-foot launches? A shooting gallery.
Zoya sighed, but Vasily acquiesced to her demand. He said,
You can go to the overwatch during the raid.
Thank you. One more thing.
What is it?
He growled.
Survivors. Give me survivors. The more the better.
Roger that, Koshka.
Zoya turned to go back downstairs to change out of her scuba gear and into clothing appropriate to return to the overwatch position. She stopped suddenly, then turned back around.
Oh, and I want the VSS up there with me, just in case.
She was speaking of the suppressed sniper rifle they had been using at the hide site all day for the reconnaissance powers of its scope. Vasily showed his frustration with a heave of his big chest, then just waved a distracted thumbs up her way before returning to his work. Court gentry approached the entrance of the raucous Bayside bar and immediately caught long looks from many of the patrons standing around near the entrance. He acted like he didn't notice and like he was perfectly comfortable, but in truth, he was already wondering if he had just ambled into a bear trap. When he'd passed through the door some 11 hours earlier, he'd been surprised to see other Western faces, but this time, there was no surprise. He was the only Guelo in the joint. He never felt relaxed standing out in any instance, but he'd known he wasn't coming here to hide out in the corner. He was coming in here to provoke a reaction. The three British assassins missing for 5 days had been in this place. Of that, Court felt certain. Something bad had happened to them, and people here knew about it. A new Western stranger was probably going to learn something about the fate of the others, Court surmised, although he knew his plan wasn't among his most subtle or nuanced. He entered the dimly lit establishment, passed the edge of the bar on his left, then made his way through tough-looking Chinese men as he walked all the way down to the opposite end of the wooden wraparound bar. He was lucky to find a single metal stool around the turn at the end, farthest from the door. He sat down, taking off his backpack and sliding it in front of him, hooking his leg around a strap as a force of habit in case of thieves. On his right, he had a wall to the kitchen, and behind him were a few empty tables in a darkened corner with concrete block walls. The covered deck layout of the bar meant that just 20 feet off his left was the railing that looked down to the dinghy dock and the water of the bay. While he'd garnered a lot of attention since he'd arrived, there was still a good bit of laughing and talking in the crowd. For every man looking his way now, there were 3 or 4 more who either didn't know or didn't care that a new Western face was in the building. The age range ran from early 20s to late 40s, but most people he saw, regardless of their age, were dressed roughly the same. Some sort of undershirt, usually a tank top, under a short sleeve shirt left completely unbuttoned. Baggy pants along with shoes or sandals. It was a common look in Hong Kong, but here it seemed to be a dress code. It slowly occurred to Court that there was a possibility, perhaps a strong possibility, that everyone in the bar belonged to the same group. He wondered if he wandered into a triad meeting. If that turned out to be the case, Court told himself he'd rip into Colonel Dai. Dai had given him a list of known Wo Xing Wo hangouts, and this wasn't on it. Court noticed a big group of men in the middle of the room, taking up the largest portion of the dockside floor. They had pulled several small plastic tables together, and they sat around it drinking and talking. Court had just looked over at this group of men when another 5 men appeared up the stairs from the floating dock and began greeting the large group. These men were clearly not Chinese. Court thought they looked Vietnamese, Laotian, or Cambodian. They shook hands and bowed to a group of Chinese at the near end of the row of tables, but on the far end, Court noticed several others who appeared to be of the same nationality as the newcomers. Since the 5 of them had just arrived from the water and he'd seen no new vessels in the bay for hours other than the Tai Chin 6, Court wondered if these 10 or so men could be from the cargo ship. Soon, a good 20 men were seated together, Chinese and foreigners alike, drinking and smoking and talking, right in the middle of the dive bar. Court took a full minute to scan his surroundings thoroughly. He decided that in any emergency, the galley kitchen, accessed from behind the bar, looked like the best possible avenue for escape, because he assumed it had a door to the outside. The only way to the kitchen from his side of the bar, however, was to go over the bar, so he'd have a damn hard time slipping away in any low-profile manner. He watched while the bartender, the same man as earlier in the day, cleaned up a double shot of whiskey that had been knocked over by a man sitting at a stool and gesticulating to friends. The booze had been spilled over the warped wood bar top, and the man behind the bar sopped it up with a hand towel, then threw the towel on a shelf behind him, all the while grumbling at the patron for his clumsiness. Court glanced down to his phone, held below the bar in his lap, and looked at the screen, which showed him a real-time view of the cargo ship from the camera placed on the hill. Using the infrared camera, he saw a couple of men on deck, but no other movement. Court looked up just in time to see the bartender lighting a cigarette, tossing the lighter back on the bar, then stepping over to him. He looked at Court a long time, unease on full display, as he recognized him as the man who had come earlier in the day and asked about the missing Brits. Court was unaccustomed to being recognized, but he cut himself some slack. He'd made this guy nervous earlier, and he'd probably been the only Western male in the establishment since then. Court smiled and faked his British accent.
"Hi again. Can I get a Tsing Tao?"
Without taking his eyes off Court, the man reached down in front of him, pulled up a cold beer from a large metal ice bucket, then popped the top off the glass bottle and placed it down in front of his new customer. Court smiled again.
"Thanks very much indeed."
The bartender didn't say a word. He just turned away and walked off with an expression that Court took for astonishment. As Court drank his beer, he kept his head low, but his eyes flicked up often enough to see that the bartender had moved down to the opposite end of the bar. He blatantly ignored one man reaching out asking for a drink and sought out a man in the crowd standing there near the entrance to the dive. The bartender leaned into the group and began talking to the man there. The man listened intently, nodded, then glanced down the length of the bar at Court. The man turned away from the bar and stepped over to a larger, younger individual standing next to the group of men seated in the middle of the room. Like a game of telephone, Court was able to watch the news of his arrival and the fact that he'd been asking about the three Brits from Sunday night make its way around the room. Yep, Court realized, everybody in this place, other than himself, was part of one big group. He was pretty sure he'd stumbled into a Wo Xing Wo get-together. His plan to instigate a reaction from the patrons had worked, but he needed to learn something from their reaction, and so far, he'd picked up nothing except that they didn't like strangers in their midst. He took a long, slow, calming breath. He was here to gather intel, not to get into a bar fight. If something bad happened, he told himself, he sure as hell was not going to be the one to start it. He'd sit here, as cool and confident as possible, and if he was confronted, he'd talk his way through it. Court feigned ignorance of the bad juju growing in the room around him, and he glanced back down to his phone one more time. He used controls on his touchscreen to adjust the view on the camera, backing out some to look around at other fishing boats, then tightening back up on the cargo ship at the mouth of the bay. But Court didn't keep his head down long. He had one foot on the floor and wrapped around his bag, the other tucked into the legs of the bar stool, ready to kick it out or hoist it up so he could use it to defend himself. He knew he needed to keep his own personal security in the forefront of his mind at all times. He would have loved to leave the bar now, to just find a quiet copse of trees somewhere on the island and to sit there alone so he could concentrate on his camera, but he didn't have that luxury. He was very aware of the fact that men from that boat out there were sitting here with him in this bar, and he had more opportunity to glean intelligence from them here than to pick up something on the boat on his night vision equipment. Just as he forcefully reminded himself to keep one eye up and on the room around him, both eyes instead locked onto the screen of his phone.
What the hell?
Quickly, Court switched from his low-light vision to his infrared and zoomed in from 3-power to 10-power. White, hot dots moved on the water's surface, right against the hull of the cargo ship at the stern. They were human-sized, clearly divers emerging from below the surface of the bay. He counted 4 close together, then 2 more up near the bow. The figures at the bow grew, then rose from the water, seeming to float in mid-air away from the ship. Court's mouth opened a little as he understood what he was looking at. 2 men were climbing the anchor chain together, with 4 more at the stern using a rope or a hooked ladder to ascend. Right now, right out there in the darkness beyond the edge of the lights from the deck bar, just at the far edges of this little bay, The cargo hauler anchored right where he'd expected to find a ship related to the disappearance of Fitzroy's men searching for Fan Xiang was being boarded by some sort of raiding party. Court looked up to check the men around him. They seemed to be more overtly looking in his direction now, while he quickly dialed a number on his phone. This meant he lost the image of the ship for a moment so he could use the number keys, but as soon as the line began to ring, he put his wired earpiece in his ear and switched back to his infrared screen. Colonel Dai answered on the first ring.
Wen Ni Hao?
Yes, hello? Court's voice was hurried and hushed.
Do you have an operation going on right now?
Of course. My men are all over Hong Kong, looking for...
Court interrupted.
I'm talking about a ship. Do you have men boarding a ship searching for Fan? Now. I mean, right now.
Dai seemed genuinely confused by the question.
No. No one has reported any sightings or investigations of that nature. What ship? Where are you? I hear talking in the background. What do you see?
Court looked around him. Young men were definitely filling the space between himself at the bar and the walkway along the bar towards the exit. No one had anything in their hands he could see, and they weren't staring him down, but they were closing in, and their bodies were showing cues that told Court they were squaring off for trouble.
Shit.
He was still convinced he could talk his way out of it, but the groupthink of 50 drinking buddies confronting one man certainly affected the attitudes around, and not in a way that encouraged polite discourse. Court said,
I'll check it out and call you back. Don't worry. This could be nothing. If it's something, I promise I'll...
Just tell me where you are, and...
Court hung up the phone, checked the ship again through the infrared cam, and saw that the two men on the anchor chain were now disappearing over the gunwale near the bow. Two of the men at the stern climbed together, one on top of the other, while two more held it steady at the waterline. Court thought it possible more men would be hitting the ship on the far side as well. Quickly, he thought about calling Brewer to ask her if he was in fact watching CIA paramilitaries in action. He knew local agency assets here were looking for Fan, and a Special Activities Division ground branch team had been moved close, ready to support him as soon as Court made contact with the target. Could this possibly be the agency conducting an operation without his knowledge? His gut told him this wasn't SAD. He doubted Brewer would let a CIA hit take place without first making sure her asset in the area wasn't in a compromised position. She might go ahead with a hit without giving him a warning, Court acknowledged, but he told himself she seemed too worried about her op getting out of hand as it was. Leaving him somewhere out in the field during a direct action didn't feel to him like the way she'd do business. Plus, Court told himself, he didn't have time to call Brewer and deal with the challenge response code. A half dozen men, all Chinese, had moved to within striking distance, and they squared off against him now. Chapter 15. Court told himself it was time to leave, but he knew the truth. The real time to leave had been 5 minutes earlier, which was about the time he walked into the bar. These guys didn't want him around, and any hope he had of leaning on one guy in a corner to get intel about Fitzroy's missing men went down the toilet the second he realized everybody in the room was on the same team. Plus, although he wasn't sure what was going on out in the water on the Tai Chin 6, he was certain he wasn't going to sit here drinking while some other group hit the cargo ship that he had discovered. He would do his best to clear out of here with apologies and then steal a boat. After that, well, one thing at a time. He fanned out a few HK dollars onto the bar, pulled his pack over a shoulder, turned to walk around the bar to head to the exit, and made it exactly 5 steps before the group of men moved directly between him and the exit. Court smiled and nodded, gave a little courteous bow, and then tried to manage his way through. They just stood there, blocking the narrow pathway between the bar stools and the tables. A voice barked angrily from the group.
Who are you? What do you want here?
A man in his 30s stepped forward through the scrum. His hair was styled in short spikes, and he had the look of triad lower-tier management. He had a blue tank top tight on his fleshy frame, and he wore a black short-sleeve shirt with orange dragons on the chest. His right hand was jammed in his front pocket. Court knew he could be hiding a weapon there, but with the baggy shirt, he could not be sure. Court looked past this man, counting heads and gauging the eyes of the others around, trying to judge their fervency to this cause. The entire establishment fell into complete silence now, all eyes on the Westerner.
"Why are you here?"
the man in the dragon shirt shouted even louder now. Court knew he needed to lay on the charm, and quick. In his British accent, he said,
"I'm a tourist, from the UK. Is there some sort of a problem?"
"You here earlier, asking about other Guelo and black man."
Court smiled a little.
"Right. Well, as I explained to that fellow right there behind the bar, I am looking for some mates who came by on Sunday night."
This appeared to be exactly the wrong answer, as more men stood from tables and joined the half dozen. Several men behind Court formed into a group and stood close there. He could make a run for the railing, 20 feet off his left shoulder, where he could then leap off the side, but he'd have to kick out far enough to miss the dinghies floating below, and he'd have to push his way around several men still sitting at tables to even get to the rail. He could also try his luck fighting his way forward or backwards, or he could move over the bar on his right, and then shoot out the back door that he assumed he'd find off the kitchen. The man with the dragon shirt drew a knife now, flicked the blade open, and held it up in front of his face.
"Show me identification. Hand over your backpack."
"Look, mate, is that necessary? How about I just leave you gentlemen to your evening, head out the door, and go on..."
"Give me your bag!"
Court was not going to let them look in his backpack. His swim fins, mask, and small air tank and regulator device, along with his cameras and his scanner, weren't going to exactly get him off the hook with these guys. Instead, he decided his only reasonable course of action was to feign compliance, to start to hand over the bag, and then to bash this fucker on the head with it. If there were 50 able-bodied guys here, he'd cut into that number with his opening move, not by an appreciable amount, but this wasn't simply a game of numbers, no. There was another important factor at play. Court had learned the power of applied aggression. Studies and papers had been written that were pored over in military and law enforcement circles, but it all boiled down to the concept that someone acting half crazy and completely sure of himself, initiating a fight with disproportionate violence, could seriously degrade an opponent's will to fight, even a much stronger or larger opposing force. And if this guy was, as Court assumed, part of the organization's leadership, it might have even more of an effect. Of course, Court put this all together in under a second. He'd undergone years of training, and he had years more of application in the field. Now he compared the situation at hand to his knowledge base in an instant, and he chose his action. Yes, the gangsters here were going to make him fight his way out of this shithole, and the only way to do so successfully was to use shock and awe to slow down their reactions to his moves. He'd crank it up to 11 and fight like a fucking madman. With his left hand, he slipped the pack off his shoulder and began extending it out in front of him while his right hand swept under the front of his black cotton shirt. The knife he'd bought in the dive shop hung in its scabbard there. More men closed in on Court, and he realized he wasn't going to win this fight if they all came at him, but he saw no choice but to hope he could winnow away attackers and pray that the others would decide they didn't think he was worth the trouble. But from his evaluation of the men's will by the looks they gave him, this wasn't going to go his way. They looked like they wanted him to resist. And then, it happened. Just as he started to move his backpack around on his wrist to swing it, a 5-round string of fully automatic gunfire rolled in from out in the bay. Court recognized it instantly as an AK-47 firing fully automatic. The muffled blast of a shotgun followed close behind. Court had been the only one in the establishment who had half expected to hear a battle rage on the cargo ship, so he was the only one who stayed on task when the firing started. The other men's heads swiveled towards the bay in surprise, giving the American a second to begin his attack. Zoya Zakharova had been lying prone, deep in the high brush of the Overwatch hide site on the far side of the bay, looking through the 10 power scope of the sniper rifle at the Tai Chin 6. All 8 of her men had disappeared moments before when they moved in teams of 4 off the main deck and into the superstructure of the 75-meter-long ship. She knew from the briefing held on the yacht earlier that they would break into teams of 2 inside to clear cabins and the engine room, with another team climbing up to the bridge deck. She could listen into their radio network through her own headset attached to her walkie-talkie, but there was nothing to hear. Anna Team was maintaining strict radio silence, and they expected the same from her. So she just lay up here alone, watching the scene. Suddenly, staccato reports of a burst of rifle fire pounded in the night, rolling across the bay from the ship. Zoya recognized it as the unmistakable sound of an AK rifle, firing 7.62 by 39 millimeter cartridges in fully automatic mode. All the Zaslon men had suppressors on their weapons that fired a different caliber, so she knew this had to be a hostile actor inside the ship engaging her commandos.
Delmo.
Shit, she said to herself. She'd hoped she wouldn't hear any noise out of the cargo ship at all. The boom of a shotgun told her that another armed hostile was firing on the raiding party, and she started to worry that this operation was falling apart right in front of her. Within 1 second of the shotgun blast, Court's backpack slammed straight down against the forehead of the man brandishing the knife, and the 5-pound air tank inside acted like a hammer striking flesh and bone. The man dropped down unconscious in front of the crowd tight behind him, while Court brought his right hand out, swinging his Kershaw knife. He made contact with 3 men in this first swing, cutting 2 men in the arm and 1 deeply in his shoulder, opening his flesh to the bone. He brought the blade back around 180 degrees in the other direction, and this time he sliced across the hands of 2 more men, while all the others around him lurched back in surprise at the violence of the action that had just erupted from the Guelo who, 2 seconds before, had been meek as a field mouse and offering no hint of resistance. Court couldn't bypass the dozen or more triad men between himself and the deck railing, so instead, he leapt high, kicking his legs into the air. He landed on his back on the wooden bar, rolled off, and dropped behind it, pulling his backpack along with him. He ended up in a standing position and swung his pack at the astonished bartender, clocking him in the face with the air tank inside the bag, dropping the young man flat onto his back. Nearly 50 men screamed in wild frenzy now, some made to leap upon the bar to climb over it, while others moved around to access it from the side closest to the entrance. Court saw knives everywhere in the scrum in front of him, but he saw no guns. Bottles of alcohol rested in a well next to Court. He grabbed 2 full, big 1.5-liter vodka bottles, then shattered their necks on the side of a waist-high refrigerator. He spun in a circle, flinging their contents all around the bar, soaking some of the men climbing onto it. He snatched up the lighter he'd seen behind the bar and lit the whiskey-soaked wash rag, which immediately burst into flames. He took a step back towards the doorway to the kitchen, then dropped the rag on the floor of the bar. The flames began instantly. The alcohol vapor in the air around the 3 liters of spilled spirits caused a brilliant flash in the low-lit room, even flaring past Court himself for an instant. Several of the men on the bar found themselves engulfed in flame, and they scrambled frantically, crashing into others while trying to get away. Court shot straight back into the narrow galley kitchen, slammed the completely inadequate door there, and reached for the lock, but didn't waste his time with it when he realized it would just take a hard push to break the weak plywood door in, locked or not. No one on the other side of that door was going to bother turning the knob. They'd come through hard and fast, and it would take no time before men began pouring at it, shattering it off its cheap hinges. The fire behind the bar wouldn't last, nor would it stop anyone who really wanted at him. It would just slow them down for a few seconds. Court's plan had been to dart through the back exit in the kitchen, but those hopes were dashed in an instant. He saw no exit that led back onto the footpath, only a closed door that, from its location at the southern end of the galley kitchen, meant it led out into the bar itself, very near the main entrance of the building. Court reached as high as he could and grabbed onto the top of a metal shelving unit full of goods right next to the door he'd just entered, and he pulled with all his might. He thought it would be difficult to tip the tall, heavy structure, but he just had to give the old, rusted unit a hard yank off-center for its legs to bend and buckle, and then the 8-foot-high assembly crashed down in front of the doorway just as the door started to push in behind the weight of several men who'd made it through the fire. The shelving unit was full of cans of spices, bags of rice, boxes full of bagged grease, and other heavy items, so it held the door shut, for a moment anyway. Court now sprinted for the other exit. It was only 5 steps away up the narrow galley, but after just 3 steps, the door flew open and a pair of rough-looking young men appeared. The first man lunged forward with his knife. Court continued his advance and sidestepped the thrust, pushing the man farther into the kitchen while the second attacker swung a switchblade towards him. The first man fell over the shelving unit while Court concentrated on the second. Court short-circuited this man's attack by blocking him at the forearm, then took hold of the hand with the knife and spun behind the man. He pulled the man's arm up high as he whirled behind him, and his own hands covered the man's hand, clutching the hilt of the knife. Driving down hard, Court forced this attacker to stab himself in the neck. While he did this, he kicked his right foot back behind him and slammed the particle board door into the face of a third attacker as he breached the doorframe. This knocked the man back into the bar, crashing him into two others just behind him. In front of Court, another crash against the plywood door broke it down and over the smashed shelving assembly and its contents. Men fell into the center of the galley kitchen on top of one another, just a dozen feet away from the American assassin. Flames still licked high in the bar area. These men had just been too wild with the thrill of the hunt to care. Court concentrated on the man in his grasp. He pulled him back a step, then spun him down to his knees against the door. With strength and efficiency, he ripped the man's hands from the knife hilt deep in his neck, then rotated the blade across the kneeling man's throat, sending a spray of arterial blood against the wooden floor and killing him almost instantly in the process. The gangster's body crumpled against the door, holding it shut from men trying to open it. Now Court turned back to the pile of undulating bodies lying in the doorway that led to the bar. The small fire from the bar area spread into the kitchen, fueled by frying grease and other items that had fallen from the crumpled shelving unit into the flames in the doorway. The pile of men, Court counted at least five so far, with more stumbling in through the dancing flames, kicked and scrambled to get up and away from the danger. Court charged at them, reaching into his right front pocket as he did so. Zoya Zakharova was pleased she hadn't heard any more shooting from the cargo ship. But now a new sound caused her to pull her eyes out of the eye cup of the scope. The roar of shouts and screams of excitement came across the water, apparently from the only area of activity around the bay, the little dive bar. Although she was 350 meters away here in her hide, the sound traveled easily in the night air over the still water. She brought her binoculars up to her eyes to check it out and, to her surprise, she saw that some kind of a barroom brawl had erupted at the same moment as the raid. She knew it was possible the patrons had heard the gunfire from the cargo ship, but she doubted they'd be able to tell that was where it came from. If men on the Tai Chin 6 had managed to contact their 10 colleagues at the bar, they could have warned them, which might have brought the Vietnamese gangsters racing back to help their comrades. But she didn't see how it would have led to a fight there. She didn't know what was going on, but any dust-up might help slow the response from the Vietnamese and cover the actions on the cargo ship, so she was pleasantly surprised at this turn of events. For a better look, she shifted the entire sniper rifle so she could train its optic on the bar, and when she did so, she saw the lighted covered deck and a large mass of people moving around the poorly constructed building. She squinted.
A fire?
It appeared the bar area was ablaze, and smoke poured from the open-air building. No one was down on the dinghy dock, which meant the Vietnamese weren't heading back to their ship to investigate the shooting there, at least not yet. So she began to lift the rifle back up so she could scan the deck of the Tai Chin 6 again. But she stopped herself suddenly and lowered her eye back to the scope. The crack of a gunshot was unmistakable over the quiet bay, and this gunfire had come from the bar, not from the ship. She couldn't see the shooter. She was too far away, but she felt like she should notify the Zaslon unit. She knew Vasily had called for radio silence and they were maintaining it, even though they were obviously engaging hostiles right now. Vasily had demanded she not transmit on the net unless absolutely necessary, but Zoya thought it prudent to tell them about the shooting going on away from the cargo ship.
All elements, this is Sarina. Be advised, there is gunfire coming from the bar on the northwestern shore of the bay. I can't see who is shooting. There is a fire there as well. There seems to be an altercation that might be unrelated to our operation.
No one replied, but she hadn't expected a response. More gunshots from the bar now. The report sounded to Zoya to be coming from pistols, at least two different weapons firing in close succession. She had no idea what the hell was going on over there, but she decided she'd focus on the bar, watching the action in case this melee caused the 10 men from the Tai Chin 6 to head back to their ship, right in the middle of the raid. Chapter 16. Court thought things couldn't get much worse. Then some asshole out in the covered deck area started shooting blindly into the galley kitchen. Awesome. As Court sprinted towards the men falling in front of him, braving the flames, stumbling over one another and the destroyed shelving unit full of cooking supplies, he heard the shots and saw holes appear in the thin wall, not far away. Court ran on, launched into the air, and planted his left foot on the edge of a metal grill. In full leap, he pushed off, vaulting high over the men in the pile, and grabbed onto the single hanging bulb lighting the kitchen area. He crushed the bulb, shattering it, and sending the kitchen into darkness, save for the flames licking in from the bar, the light of which did not reach into the far end of the galley. Still, he stuck his landing at the northern end of the kitchen because he'd calculated his trajectory before the light went out. Court spun around, turning on the tactical flashlight he pulled from his pocket. The tac light sent 900 lumens of blinding white light back in the direction of the men climbing over the shelves, cans, and boxes. He laid the 5-inch-long device on a shelf over a sink just to his right, so the beam would remain constant up the galley and hide Court's actions. Above the shelf, he saw a stock knife rack nailed into a wooden support beam. Court yanked the meat cleaver and a long carving fork off the rack, just as a man charged forward through the light, his eyes surely blinded, but either his adrenaline or his stupidity pushing him on. He held a stiletto in his hand. Court dispatched the man with a parry of the knife with the carving fork and a brutal strike to the side of the neck with the meat cleaver. The man fell and writhed on the cement floor of the galley, and Court stepped back, nearly to the back wall, ready to take the next 10 men to try their luck up the narrow aisle. More Hong Kong triads shielded their eyes and braved the danger of having no idea where the Guello in front of them was. Another crack of a gunshot caught Court's attention, but he didn't stop swinging as another man closed in the narrow space. He struck this man in the arm with the cleaver, causing the attacker to drop his blade and fall, clutching a long and deep slash. The man just behind him stumbled over his fallen comrade and fell to the ground on his forearms and knees. Court drop-kicked this attacker in the face, spinning him 180 degrees before he fell in a heap. Persistent gunfire cracked outside in the bar now. Court saw the holes in the walls getting closer to his position, and he knew he'd be hit in seconds if he waited around for the shooters to adjust their aim. The walls! Court had noticed earlier in the day that this dive looked like it had been put together with flypaper and baling wire. There was no way out of the corner he'd backed himself into, unless he made his own exit. He heel-kicked at the wall behind him as hard as he could. It moved, shaking the entire kitchen, but the thin plywood held. As another man climbed off the pile and raced towards him with a blade, rushing out of the dazzling beam of light, Court kicked again, lower on the wall, trying to hit another of the weak boards at its least secure point. This time he heard a crack, and the board separated from its fasteners. The new man sprang on him, faked a kick that caused Court to commit to blocking, then barreled in with a jab of the knife. Court dropped fast to his knees, causing the blade to fire just inches above his upper back. Then Court spun on his hands and kicked out hard, striking the man in the ankle on his weight-bearing leg. The appendage cracked and the man fell forward. Court propped the carving fork on the floor, business end up. His attacker fell straight down onto it, killing him instantly. On the ground now, with men just feet away and surging forward like a flood, Court rolled out of his backpack, flipped onto his back, and kicked at the loose board at the back of the wall with the heels of both feet. After one hit, it bent away and cracked again. A second try broke the board all the way through, sending it flying into a far corner of the bar's back deck. Just then, Court saw the beam of his tactical light whip around the kitchen as someone knocked it to the floor. Court rolled onto his belly and scooted backwards, pulling his backpack behind him. He scraped his back as he did so, but he barely felt it in his overwhelming desire to get away from all the men trying to kill him. Here he sprang to his feet, finding himself back in the bar, in the corner behind where he had been seated just a couple of minutes earlier. He was around the corner from the main part of the bar, but there was no way out from here, so he had to head in the direction of the gunfire and his triad attackers. He chanced to look around the corner, knowing this wooden wall wouldn't stop an air rifle from penetrating, much less a real pistol. He saw the near edge of the bar where he'd been sitting just a few feet away, and he knew there was a huge metal ice bin just on the other side. He thought the ice bin would give him some cover from a handgun. No one followed him out of the kitchen through the small hole because they knew there was a man on the other side with a blood-soaked meat cleaver in his hand, so by now men had begun flooding out of the kitchen doors, and word was surely getting out that the man pinned in the corner of the kitchen had managed to escape back into the open decked bar. As Cort moved towards his cover behind the ice bin, he saw the man wearing the dragon shirt that he'd hit over the head with his pack to kick off the fight. He was sitting on the ground, bleeding from the head, and holding a silver automatic pistol in his right hand. He was only 15 feet away from Cort and facing away, and as Cort watched, the man pointed his pistol over the bar and fired a round into the kitchen wall without seeing what he was shooting at. He nearly hit one of his fellow triads in the process. Cort sprang towards the man on the floor now, twisted the pistol out of his hand, and grabbed him by his spiked black hair. As men seemed to run around the entire dim establishment, some firing pistols themselves, Cort began dragging the man backwards towards the relative cover of the ice bin. He looked up as he did so, and it appeared that everyone in the room turned in his direction at the same time. 20 men charged, and Cort found himself out in the open, pulling along a non-compliant hostage. With her eyes still in the scope, Zoya Zakharova pulled the charging handle back on the VSS rifle, chambering a 9x39mm round. She hadn't envisioned using the weapon this evening at all, and she hadn't fired a VSS since her sniper training 4 years earlier, but she had a target downrange now, and she was committed to killing him. She followed the man's head with the crosshairs of the rifle, holding just a touch high to account for the characteristics of this bullet at this distance. The Russian operative blew out half the air in her lungs, hesitated a moment to catch her body between heartbeats, and then pressed the trigger. The sound of the round firing through the integrally suppressed barrel was akin to a bicycle tire blowing out. A pop and an expression of gases made less noise than the action of the weapon itself, as the semi-automatic rifle ejected the spent cartridge and then rechambered around. The large bullet left the muzzle of the rifle at 1,000 feet per second, then raced from the top of the hill and over the full length of the bay. Zoya kept her eyes on her target, the forehead of a man in motion, and when the bullet struck home, there was no doubt, because she saw the head snap back, blood mist behind it, and then the body dropped like a stone. The man landed flat on his back in the 15-foot-long boat. There were 2 more men in the tender rushing towards the Tai Chin 6, but neither of them was aware that the man kneeling just behind them had been shot through the head. The roar of the outboard motor had covered the zing of the bullet as it flew overhead, its impact with its target, and the fall of the man to the floor of the small watercraft. Mere seconds earlier, Zoya had watched these men race down the stairs of the bar to their boat, one of them with a walkie-talkie held to his ear. She took it as a given they were in communication with someone on the cargo ship, and were now rushing away from the fight at the bar and back to the fight on the ship. The men then leapt into the closest of the 2 tenders and fired the engines, while Zoya reported the action to the Zaslan team. She hadn't looked to see if Ruslan and Sasha, the 2 men Vasily had tasked with covering any counterattack, had made it back up to the deck of the cargo ship, out in the darkness off her left shoulder, and she wasn't going to move her rifle now to find out. But when she received no response from Vasily after 15 seconds, she knew what she had to do. After her first shot and the elimination of the first of the 3 threats to her mission, she quickly centered her crosshairs on the man just behind the operator of the tender, but this time she held her sights true to aim, because the fast-moving vessel had moved closer to her position, eliminating the need for the holdover. Thump! Another round left her weapon, but just as it did, the operator of the boat steered hard to starboard, apparently to avoid a buoy in the water in front of him. Zoya worried for an instant her shot would miss, but she watched through the scope while the round slammed into the target's left collarbone, knocking the man backwards and flat in the tender. Zoya's weapon loaded the chamber automatically, and her finger remained taut on the trigger. She centered her sights on the man at the wheel now, piloting the vessel at full throttle past a small fishing boat moored for the evening. The tender continued towards the cargo ship, still 150 meters off its bow. She fired again, striking the operator of the tender straight in the nose, knocking him off the boat and then into the black water with a splash. The tender slowed to idle, then veered to its left a little and began sputtering towards the rocky shoreline, across the bay from the dive bar and just under Zoya's position on the hill. She scanned for other targets, but the second tender of the Tai Chin 6 remained tied up on the dinghy dock under the righteous fight in the bar. Into her mic, she said,
"This is Serena. 3 hostiles are down."
She shot the men back to front, dropping all 3 with only 3 rounds. And although the weapon had flashed up here at the top of the hill, no one would have heard the gunshots from any distance, so she felt comfortable that she was in the clear. More importantly to her, this small rescue mission to the Tai Chin 6 had failed, even if any of the 3 had somehow managed to survive. She spoke into her microphone again after triggering her radio.
"Anna 1, how copy?"
There was no response from the Zaslon team, but a lightning flash 3-round volley of gunfire from the waterside bar diverted her attention. From the speed of the fire, Zoya knew that someone new was shooting, and whoever it was, they sure as hell knew how to operate a handgun. Court fired 3 rounds over the far end of the bar, striking 3 men charging in his way. The mass of approaching men recoiled like a single living organism, and the attackers began diving behind tables and chairs and against the bar itself. A few even leapt over the deck railing down into the water below, next to the little dock. With one hand still grabbing hard to the sticky hair of the triad boss in the dragon shirt, Court fanned the pistol around behind him, checking his 6 to make sure no one was there. A waitress lay huddled behind the table in the corner, just in his view. Court yelled at her to stay where she was, because he was afraid if she got up to run, she would get shot by one of the Chinese or Vietnamese men pointing guns in this direction. The triad on the dirty deck, now pinned there by Court's knee, looked up to him with blood all over his face.
"Let me go! I will kill you if you don't let me go!"
Court used his left hand to bang the man's face down hard against the deck, silencing him for the time being. A shout came from the men holding their positions just 30 or so feet away.
"Hey, Guido! You gonna die, motherfucker?"
Court pushed harder with his left knee to hold his captive down, and then he released his left hand from the man's hair. He dropped the magazine from the grip of the pistol, a Norinco Type 92, and saw he had 8 rounds left. It wasn't a particularly powerful weapon, but Court knew his marksmanship would go a long way to make up for any shortcomings of the 5.8x21mm round. His mind assessed his situation quickly. There were still easily 25 or so potential threats here in this bar, but from the sound of the gunfire, there weren't more than 1 or 2 pistols in the crowd other than the one in his hand. He wasn't terribly worried about the knives now that he had a standoff weapon. Unless they all charged him at once, nobody was going to get into a knife fight with the gray man if he had a gun. He heard a boat fire up downstairs at the dinghy dock, and he wondered if it was one of the tenders for the cargo ship. He thought he'd heard one a minute earlier as well, but it was hard to tell with all the action going on. With the revving of an outboard motor's throttle, he was certain now he was listening to a tender racing away from the bar. Another voice shouted out, startling Court and forcing his head down lower. This man spoke in Mandarin, and from the tone of his words, it sounded to Court like he was barking out orders to underlings. A few other men replied, and it felt as if some kind of plan was being formed by the gang. Not good. Court didn't have a moment to spare. The longer he stayed here, the braver the men plotting against him would get, and the more organized their next attack would be. Suddenly, several shots rang out in quick succession. Court heard glasses behind the bar shattering nearby, the sound of the ice bucket taking fire. He even saw splinters of wood kicked off the corner of the bar a foot from his face.
Christ,
Court thought. These guys didn't have much concern about the well-being of the triad boss on the floor under his knee. Court reached the pistol around the side of the bar and fired 2 rounds without looking. The angle of the pistol was right to hit threats here in this target-rich environment, so even though he couldn't see what he was shooting at, he figured he was doing some damage. The gunfire from the crowd stopped, but the shouting, the ordering, and the callbacks all continued. Court assumed they were coordinating some sort of plan that included covering gunfire to pin Court down, along with a movement forward by all the men with the edged weapons. He felt around the body of the man underneath him, desperately searching for another magazine, but found nothing save for a wallet and a cell phone. Court took a quick half-peek around the corner. He saw dead bodies and wounded men around the tipped-over tables, then movement a little farther back on the deck. He heard the rushed voices of several men. He grabbed the triad roughly by the neck and climbed off the man's back, staying low in a crouch, as if ready to launch. The man Court held looked at him with a crazed grin now.
Stupid Guelo! They don't care if they kill me! You use me as hostage? Are you fucking crazy, man? I know hostage. They shoot anyway!
Court looked to the railing of the deck 20 feet across open ground. Upturned plastic chairs and tables lay in the way, but nothing he couldn't bull his way through in a desperate situation. And he was pretty sure this predicament qualified. Court pulled the triad up to his feet, but kept him in a low crouch. Leaning into the man's ear with his eyes on the railing, he said,
"You aren't my hostage, buddy."
Court looked straight into the man's eyes now.
"You're my meat shield."
The triad leader cocked his head in confusion, and then Court propelled himself up and out to the left, using his strong thighs to haul the man up with him. With his gun arm out in front of him, he used the man in the dragon shirt for cover. Court opened fire, simultaneously pulling the man along with him as he went for the railing. Cracks of return pistol fire filled the night. The zing of a bullet burned the air inches from Court's ear. He pulled the triad sideways as he moved, 3 feet, 5 feet, 10 feet, straight towards the railing over the water, as fast as Court could go while yanking an unwilling man along with him. The triad boss lurched into Court as they shuffled quickly along like two men dancing badly. Clearly, he'd been shot. Then he lurched again a second later, another round in the back. Court's pistol emptied and he dropped it, using both hands now to pull his meat shield along with him across the floor. The dying man took another shot, this time to the back of his head, and his legs gave out, but Court didn't let him drop. Gunshots cracked across the room. Court both felt and heard a round scream by again, this time even closer to his own head, but he raced forward anyway, towards the edge of the deck. Men with knives launched to their feet and gave chase now, getting in the way of the guns, and Court let the dead body in his arms fall, then turned and sprang onto the railing. The closest blade was just 2 feet away and swinging fast as the gray man dove over the side, launching himself out past the dinghy dock. He was going for a swan dive. It was the fastest and most efficient way to get himself in the water, but as he dropped, his legs rotated past 90 degrees, and he hit the water with his outstretched hands, then his head, then his back and legs. It wasn't pretty, but the lights of the bar above didn't make it down to the water's surface, so once he broke through, his momentum sending him deep, he knew he was out of the line of sight and the line of fire. As long as he didn't need to breathe. Chapter 17. Zoya's attention had been on a different part of the bay. She had just lined her rifle up on one of the four men in the second tender to launch from the bar in the past 3 minutes, when the man in her sights tumbled out of the boat and into the water. She was confused for an instant, but when a second man dropped down in the boat a moment later, she understood. Ruslan and Sasha were firing their silenced rifles at the little boat from the deck of the cargo ship off to her left. The SVR operative on the hill at the southeast edge of the bay flipped her weapon's fire selector switch up to the safe setting, then moved the rifle to her right, pointing it back at the bar. She was fascinated by what sounded like a full-on gun battle raging in there, and she wanted to see if she could get eyes on more of the action to determine what the hell was going on. Just as she put her eye back in the cup of the scope, she focused quickly on movement. A man flew through the air, face down and arms outstretched, swan diving out of the bar and chased by what looked like 2 dozen or more frenzied men. She saw nothing of the diver before he splashed awkwardly into the black surface, other than the fact that he had dark clothing and he wore a backpack. Men leaned over the railing now and held pistols at the water. Flashlight beams swept the bay, hunting for the man who disappeared there. She put her crosshairs on one of the armed men on the deck, but she did not fire. He wasn't engaging her men and was no threat at all to her operation. She watched the water through her scope for over a minute, waiting for the diver to resurface. While she peered intently, half in disbelief at the diver's ability to hold his breath, Vasily came over the net for the first time since the raid began.
Anna 1 to all call signs. Objective secure. Report in.
Zoya listened carefully while all 8 Zaslan men checked in over the radio. Only one, Peter, had been injured in the takedown, and he reported he was ambulatory and did not need any aid. Satisfied and relieved, she pulled away from the rifle and sat up. She pressed her mic transmit button and jumped onto the net herself.
This is Sarina. How many survivors?
There was a delay, to the point that Zoya called back into her radio.
Did you copy my last?